Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. The late Milton Friedman, one of the greatest economists of the 20th century, said of our guest today that, quote, he understands economics in all its subtlety, close quote. An academic? The author of obscure tomes? No. A television personality and the author, most recently, of No, They Can't. On Uncommon Knowledge today, John Stossel. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Be sure to join us on our website at hoover.org/UK or on Facebook at facebook.com/UNCKnowledge, facebook.com/UNCKKnowledge. Joining us today, John Stossel, host of the Thursday primetime show on Fox Business, Stossel. Before joining Fox, Mr. Stossel, a graduate of Princeton, spent almost three decades at ABC. He has won 18 Emmys and published two bestsellers, Give Me a Break and Myths, Lies, and Downright Stupidity. Mr. Stossel's new book, No, They Can't, Why Government Fails But Individuals Succeed. John Stossel, welcome.
Thank you.
You brought a sign with you. I want to ask about the sign right away. Okay. Not every guest walks in with a sign, John.
I'm a TV guy. I like props. I have this fantasy that the Tea Party will respond to this book, and the No, They Can't title is in response to the hysteria last election of Yes, We Can.
Right.
And we can, but we, to them, became government, and I would say No, They Can't. So my fantasy is that there'll be Tea Party people going to state capitals in Washington saying, No, they can't. Because they can't.
Because they can't. No, they can't. Quote, the natural human instinct is to say, why doesn't the government do something? What government usually does is make the problem worse. Why don't we ever learn? Close quote. Right there, three sentences, right at the beginning of the book. You have the grounds there for at least one thesis in American political theory. First of all, why is it the natural human instinct to say the government, somebody ought to do something?
I think because we grew up with mommy and daddy who run our lives. And then our ancestors grew up in clans of 50, 100, 200 people where if you didn't listen to the clan leader, you were dead and didn't give birth to us. You had to harvest the fruit when he said it was time to harvest the fruit, and those who did live to give birth to us. So we're programmed to take orders from Washington. We want to. And also, we have lives. Life is complex. I can't get my brain around how you build a sewage treatment plant myself. My instinct is to say, let them do it. And Thomas Jefferson said it's the natural progress of things for government to grow.
All right. You organize No, They Can't around several dozen very compelling summary statements. And every summary statement takes the form, what intuition tempts us to believe and what reality has taught me. So let's take a few right at the top here. No, they can't. Quote, what intuition tempts us to believe when there's a problem, government should act. What reality taught me, individuals should act, not government. Close quote. Why a preference for individual action over collective action through the government?
Just from what I've observed in 43 years of reporting. I mean, Milton Friedman got two things wrong. One was proposing withholding tax, which made people not feel
taxes. He admitted
taxes.
He got that wrong, yes, right.
And the other one was this blurb for my book that you read where he said, I understand economics and all its subtleties. That I was a psychology major. I don't understand. There's so much I don't understand about economics. But as a consumer reporter, and I stayed on the beat because I'm a stutterer and I didn't want to go out there and compete with Sam Donaldson and the other people screaming at press conferences, I stayed there and watched the market work, and I got some sense how people work things out, and often for profit. People do amazingly clever and successful things out of self-interest, while government mucks it up, and it would happen again and again. As a consumer reporter, I would call for government to fix this, and you know, they would pass all these rules. It would make things cost more, but it wouldn't make it better. And they couldn't even get rid of the obvious fraud, the burn fat while you sleep pills and the breast enlargers. They're still selling that stuff. So all the regulation didn't do any good. But quietly, the private sector performs miracles.
Mm-hmm. No, they can't. Once again, what intuition tempts us to believe, someone needs to plan, and the central planners know best. What reality taught me, no one knows enough to plan a society. John, you quote Friedrich Hayek, a pal of Milton Friedman, while we're talking about Milton Friedman. And Hayek, this observation that there's too little information to plan centrally. Hayek's writing when the Soviets are trying to plan, come up with five-year plans and so forth. But he's writing in the middle of the 20th century. Now we have so much more information, all kinds of data rolling into Washington wave after wave. So surely you'd have to grant, for example, with regard to Obamacare, that even if the government can't plan the health economy in detail, surely it has enough information now about costs and procedures to give it at least overall direction.
No, I can't agree to that. And even if it did, it doesn't know what you or I are going to do next or going to want next. It can't know. I mean, you may want every ounce of health care, and you may choose to spend your last penny on health care. I'm someone who would rather take risks and have a shorter life, and government can't know it for everybody. Hayek also said, the curious task of economics is to teach man how little he knows about what he imagines he can design. And that's right on.
Still right on.
It's my job to convince Bill O'Reilly now.
Good luck. Good luck. One more from No, They Can't that I think is especially important as we head into the campaign season, presidential campaign season. Again, what intuition tempts us to believe, the important thing is to have heroic leaders. What reality taught me, real heroes don't control other people's lives.
Right. I'm suspicious of the student council presidents who want to run other people's lives.
You don't. You're of just the right generation to have been moved by John Kennedy's inaugural address. You don't like the heroic mode in American politics?
I was moved by that. Hell, I'm a sucker. I was moved by Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and how he was going to cure poverty.
You have low standards.
But I watched them work, and I was gung-ho, calling for more regulation. I watched it fail. I'm not as smart as you or maybe some of you. It took me 15 years to figure out that that wasn't working.
All right. Segment two, the education of John Stossel. You attend in Princeton in the late 1960s. This is at the height of the hippie movement. The anti-war movement is well underway. You majored in psychology, and your hero, you admit all this, amazingly enough, your hero was Ralph Nader. If you were called upon to give an account of yourself as a college student, what defense would you offer? What was in your head that was admirable to have been in the head of an 18 and 19 and 20-year-old at Princeton University in the late 60s, liberal that you were?
Well, I also have to admit that I wasn't paying all that much attention. I was interested in poker and meeting women and trying to get good grades with the least amount of work. But Nader had gone to Princeton, and I never intended to become a TV reporter, but I fell into this job where I was doing research and then became a consumer reporter. And Ralph Nader was the guy who started all that. He caught GM, and GM had him followed. It wasn't hard to see who the bad guys were there. The big company had this investigative activist,
right,
followed by private,
right,
detectives. They wear suits. The activists wear blue jeans. The blue jean guys obviously are the good guys, and the Corvair is unsafe at any speed. Turns out it was no worse than any other car, but that started me on a crusade. He's doing it by getting activists to push it. I can do it on television.
So you were – I actually think you're saying something pretty profound there about a lot of American journalism, which is to say that it's an easy extension – from the college kid who's up at night playing poker and trying to figure out how to get good grades without working, the usual impulse of a college student, to crusading journalism, because you pick up the template that already exists. Big business bad, little activist good, big government good, capitalist bad. It's the easiest thing to do if you're going into journalism. Simply pick up the template that had already been worked out, right?
Yes, plus I had no journalism training. Maybe if I'd gone to some journalism school and they had said...
How did that happen? Your older brother is now an esteemed medical researcher and a medical administrator, went to med school, everybody's mother's dream child, I imagine. And how did you end up Princeton? I mean, that's a very expensive, fancy education, and you went into journalism and not... You didn't try to become another Walter Lippmann. You ended up in television journalism. How did that happen, John?
And my mother said, gee, you're in this profession with the clowns and the jugglers. When are you going to go get a graduate degree and get a real job? It happened because I didn't like school. And I thought if I worked for a year, I might appreciate it more. And I applied and was accepted to the University of Chicago School of Hospital Management. So I thought...
Oh, so you tried to follow in your brother's footsteps, sort of.
Sort of. I was not as smart as he. I'm still not as smart as he. He's reading Human Action in the Bathroom as we speak. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. So it was 1969. It was a good year for the economy. Lots of companies came to campus and interviewed undergraduates. And I went to just about all of them searching for what would appeal, what might be my career. And I had no clue, but the most interesting job offer came from this Seattle magazine because it was in Seattle. And it was the longest free airplane ride. So I thought, well, I'll go see the Northwest. I've never been there. And then Seattle magazine folded before I got there. And they said, you want to work as a researcher in our TV newsroom? I said, sure. I'd never even watched television news. And I'd never done journalism. I was the business manager of the Daily Princetonian. And once I tried to write a story and they said, no, leave the journalism to us. And I'd gotten my worst grades in English always. But I learned through fear. My immigrant parents had always said, you better work hard or you'll freeze in the dark. And I watched what the on-air people did. And I'm ambitious. And I decided more research was good. And I didn't want to be covering politics because of my stuttering, and I noticed nobody was really covering science or business or medicine, really. Mm-hmm. I'll cover that. I became one of the first TV consumer reporters. And then I would get angry at the businessman who I thought was cheating people. So I would do stings. We would take a TV set to a bunch of repair shops with a loose part. Most would say, loose part, no charge. Some would say, I got to take it in. Charges $200 later. And, you know, no journalism school taught that. I just
did it
because I thought it was good television. And maybe it's not good journalism because I was a crusading journalist and the pompous reporters of the time did not approve that kind of thing. But that is what won me my Emmys.
You had a very big career. You start in local television
because
in Seattle. You go to a local station in New York, which, of course, is where you go when you're being noticed. And then you got picked up at ABC while still very, very young. Good Morning America, then 2020, the big prestigious show at ABC. And before long, you're a co-anchor of 2020. All a very big deal. And as you move upward in this career, you're moving to the right politically. How come?
I was mugged by reality. I won the Emmys, criticizing business, calling for regulation. The same story about the TV repair shops. The politicians would call after and say, that was great television. We're going to fix that. We're going to pass a law. And young John Stossel was so flattered. All these important people are paying attention to me. And they created a Department of Consumer Affairs because of that. And I was so happy. But then I would do this thing again a year later. And the results were the same. Most people were honest. Some would cheat. And I went, so what's the department doing? And I'd go there, and there were a bunch of dreary desks and people filling out forms, and now they were licensing all repair shops. And that sounds good. We like licensing. We license drivers. We license dogs.
Right.
It makes people feel safe. But they weren't improving the quality. What was going on? So I saw that it made everything cost more. And now if you wanted to run a repair shop, you had to hire a lawyer just to understand the rules. If you were an immigrant, maybe you couldn't do it. You had to go underground or... You didn't do it at all. And it didn't make it better. And I saw it again and again. They weren't stopping the consumer fraud. Then I thought, aha, the trial lawyers will do it because they have real clout. I can just tell people.
Right.
They can make them pay. and compensate the victim. I'd refer people to trial lawyers because consumers now were calling me and saying, this person ripped me off and so forth. How am I going to solve this? Government? No, trial lawyers. Then people would call and say, my lawyer ripped me off. So I looked at the conservative press. I looked at National Review. And I, you know, they seemed at the time to be wanting to police the bedroom and police the world. And that didn't appeal to me either. I had grown up in the New York Times. They no longer made sense. National Review didn't fully make sense to me. I discovered Reason magazine, the libertarian magazine. And that was an epiphany. It was, oh, my goodness, these people really get it. And they understand it better than I. And they're talking about Locke and John Stuart Mill. I read them in college, but I didn't connect these dots. And and then I realized there was another truth out there. And I read a little more, and I became a born-again free marketer.
28 years at ABC, and one of the summary statements in No, They Can't is as follows. What intuition tempts us to believe big business runs the media, so the media support big business. What reality taught me, the media hate business. Close quote.
The kind of people who go into journalism don't like capitalism. And people at universities don't like capitalism. I'm trying to figure out what this is about. At first, I thought, well, it's because the college professor, his slightly stupider roommate, went into business and makes more than he does, so he's envious.
Resentful, right.
And the wealth disparity makes people uncomfortable. It's a byproduct of freedom. If you have a free market, some people are going to get absurdly rich, and others don't have that. But then I thought about the kings and queens of old Europe, and they have vastly more wealth than the average person, yet they weren't hated. They were revered. But people hated the bourgeoisie. They gave them that nasty name. They hated the very people. This is a Thomas Sowell insight. They hated the very people who sold them the things they needed to make their lives better. So I'm trying to think, what's that about? And there's all this hatred of me at the same time, because I live in Manhattan. Somebody came up to me on the street and said, you John Stossel? Yes. I hope you die soon. And at first I thought it was because they considered...
By the way, you write that Peter Jennings, when you passed in the hallway, Peter Jennings would avert his eyes.
And more dramatically, he would go.
Oh, really?
Because I was an embarrassment to ABC News because I was not objective. So do they hate me because I'm a conservative? And where I live, that's like being a child molester. It's the worst thing you can be. But I'm a libertarian. I'm a lousy conservative. I think homosexuality is just fine and drugs should be legal and gambling and sex work between consenting adults. So I would thought the liberals would like me, but they're so angry because I'm a consumer reporter defending laissez-faire capitalism. And why are they so threatened by that? And I think it's because intuitively you think of business as a zero-sum game, or liberals do. So if Bill Gates got a lot of money, we must have less. If somebody makes a profit, I have less. That's why they hated the bourgeoisie. They don't understand that business is win-win.
Segment three, the economy, the government, and us. No, they can't. What intuition tempts us to believe government can get the economy moving again. What reality taught me, government does not spend money better than individuals do. Close quote. Explain that.
The economy is not like an orchestra that needs a conductor to start or a car that needs jump starting. An economy is people with needs. And if you leave them alone, they will do amazing, wonderful things to achieve those needs. I mean, we take them for granted. We take it for granted that a supermarket has 30,000 products, and they're all cheap, and it's well-lit, it's open 24/7, and they rarely poison us. People do stuff if we don't get in the way. And the Keynesians in the administration were saying, we can spend money better than the private sector can. We have to start it in this multiplier effect, which is just nonsense. The government can create jobs. They created jobs building pyramids. But think how much wealthier the Egyptians would have been had they been free to pursue their own interests.
John, the financial crisis of 2008, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan testifying before Congress. Alan Greenspan, I note for you, my libertarian friend, my reader of Reason magazine, was a disciple and friend of Ayn Rand. As libertarian as they come, Alan Greenspan. Well, okay, quote.
Isn't anymore.
Quote.
Isn't in this quote you're about to read.
No, yes, it is, in a way. I'm testifying before Congress. I, Alan Greenspan, I made a mistake in presuming that the self-interest of banks was such that they were best capable of protecting their own shareholders, that the loan officers of those institutions knew more about the risks involved than even our best regulators. A critical pillar to free markets did break down. That shocked me. I still do not fully understand why it happened. Close quote. If Alan Greenspan says that the financial crisis of 2008 was a market failure, who is John Stossel to gainsay him?
And who is John Stossel when Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner and all these very smart Wall Street experts say they had to bail these people out?
Yeah, yeah. Well, in other words, how do you put the – a lot of people will say, right, okay, I'm with you in the great general arc of sort of the Matt Ridley argument. If you start 1,000 years ago, the upward climb is impressive. But come on, John, we've got problems with capitalism. It needs adjustment. It needs oversight. Latest example, 2008. And John Stossel replies,
the oversight won't work. And the overseers will never understand the banking business and the tricks or the cheating as well as the cheaters and the tricksters will. So you can pass Sarbanes-Oxley after Enron. That's going to end all the scams in the future. And that didn't stop Bernie Madoff or the housing bubble, and Dodd-Frank isn't going to stop this either. And Alan Greenspan's problem, I believe, is that watching from the point of view of the media over these years, is that the people closest to the panic always get too scared. Mm. The global warming scientists say, we have to take action against global warming. The bird flu doctors want all our money to go to researching bird flu. The killer bee coming up from Mexico going to sting us all to death. The Y2K computer experts that said the planes are going to crash. They all want government action. Robert Higgs said war is the friend of the state. Well, so is crisis and fear. The thing is that the global warming experts and the killer bee experts were not in the Treasury Department. It did not have the power to scarf up $1 trillion of your dollars and give it to their friends who were scared and calling from Goldman Sachs. Oh, my God, it's the end of the world. I'm losing everything. You have to rescue this company. And they got scared. I argue market discipline will protect us better. And that means no privileges, no bailouts.
Okay, so another one of these summary statements. What intuition tempts us to believe some institutions are too big to fail. What reality taught me, failure makes markets work. Okay, so let's just – you're saying that the conventional wisdom is now that the government made a big mistake in failing to bail out Lehman Brothers. That was the mistake. That was what caused the trouble. Stossel says, no, go back. The mistake was the bailout, was supporting Bear Stearns and arranging a sale, saving the institution. Should have let him go down. The mistake was bailing out AIG. That's your position, right?
Bear Stearns would have, at the right price, found a buyer for whatever assets they had left. Likewise,
okay.
GM.
So your argument is not that absent government intervention, there would have been no crisis. Your argument is we're human beings. We live in a fallen world. People screw up. Sometimes they screw up in large ways. Capitalism will experience crises. The government would make it worse. You're not saying that it would be crisis-less without the government. You're simply saying the government would make it worse, right? Or does make
yes,
it worse.
Yes, but it's right? worse than that. I'm saying more than that. I'm saying government caused the crisis. Canada didn't have the same housing bubble. They don't have a Fannie and Freddie, and they have the same rate of home ownership. And government makes it worse because
Greenspan pumped too much liquidity into the system.
Perhaps, probably, but more, we have the FHA and all these agencies subsidizing reckless behavior.
Okay. No, they can't. What intuition tempts us to believe, if auto companies are in trouble, government should encourage the purchase of new cars. I'm giving you an easy one after Alan Greenspan. What reality taught me, wealth will be destroyed and poor people will be hurt. Okay, go ahead. Take a stick to Cash for Clunkers.
It's again, intuitive, though. On the book tour, a woman came up to me and said, intuitive is a lousy word that you use because intuition is generally right. I said, well, what's a better word? She said, we're imprinted. And I think she may be right.
Conditioned, right, yeah.
Or instinct. I don't know. Instinct is often right. But when Cash for Clunkers came out, a lot of people said, oh, yeah, this makes sense. The auto business is struggling. pay people $3,000, get rid of old cars, and they right. pollute more. We'll clean the air a little right. and stimulate the auto business. But, again, government has no money of its own. The $3,000 comes from somebody, comes taken from the private sector. Now, some of us might have bought a car that year. Some of us had our purchases sped up. The money went to the auto companies. It gave a bubble in car purchases. But then that goes down on the other end. More importantly, what did they do with these junked cars? They destroyed them. It really shows government arrogance to think you can create wealth by destroying things. Nancy Pelosi believed that and said that after the Haitian earthquake. This will cause a boom in Haiti, she said, because of the construction work. Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winner, believed it, said that about 9/11. But it will cause some construction, but it's the Frederick Bastiat's broken window fallacy. A boy breaks a store window. Hey, he's creating a job for a janitor and a glassmaker. But that's the seen benefit. We can see that work.
Right.
What we can't see is what that money might have been used for had the window not been broken. Maybe the storekeeper would have bought a shirt. Maybe okay. he would have cured cancer.
John, what about the great, you've just batted away the 2008 crisis. What about the great Keynesian?
Oh, so why is it a crisis? Man, the stock market fell a lot. But in 82, the stock market was at 800. So we got up to 14,000 and fell to 8,000. It had had an amazing run.
That's because you were working at Midtown instead of downtown, so it wasn't a crisis for you.
It was horrible for them. But, you know, right. a crisis is the Revolutionary War soldiers freezing when the British are coming, or the okay. Civil War, or the bubonic plague.
There's a crisis.
Save our crises.
Okay, listen. The great Keynesian example is the economic benefit to the United States of the Second World War. We can agree, I think probably you and I do agree, that the evidence, Amity Schles and her Forgotten Man, the evidence that the New Deal actually lifted the economy is zero. It moved things around. It favored some people. Didn't get things. But the Second World War comes along. The country shifts to a war footing. Government spending expands enormously. And the economy hums. How come? If it's not government spending, if it's not the Keynesian argument that the private sector is spending too little, once the government kicks in, even if it's war spending, you get an economy humming.
It's a great question, and I'm not a student of that. My understanding is you had great national purpose. People worked together. The economy really started humming after the war. You may have read that when the soldiers were all coming home, people said unemployment is going to be hugely high. And yet it wasn't.
Right.
Those soldiers found new things to do, and that, to my understanding, caused the boom. But I'm not a student of that.
Segment 4, John Stossel's Cold, Cold, Miserable Heart. No, they can't. Quote, my wife used to complain. Used to. I'm interested in that. Used to complain that libertarian reasoning is cold-hearted. Since markets produce winners and losers, and many losers did nothing wrong, market competition is cruel. She had a point, didn't she?
Market competition is cruel. There are winners and losers. But that's better than the alternative where there are only losers.
All right. The President of the United States on simple fairness. And you pay close attention to this, please.
That means we have to make choices. When it comes to paying down the deficit and investing in our future, should we ask middle-class Americans to pay even more at a time when their budgets are already stretched to the breaking point? Or should we ask some of the wealthiest Americans to pay their fair share? That's the choice.
The Buffett rule. The Buffett rule. Rich people should be asked to pay at least the same proportion of their income as middle-class people. Transparently fair, right?
It sure feels fair, and I think it's a good political selling point. It's a much harder point to say they're not going to pay it no matter what, because the rich people are going to hire accountant and lawyer tricksters to escape it or move out of the jurisdiction. Or worse, they're going to do less, and some of them are the golden geese who provide opportunity for poor people. My response to – and these are much tougher things to say in simple politics. It's a tough battle. Obama is very clever. But I say to him, give me a break. You and Bush doubled spending. Under Clinton, we spent $2 trillion. Now we're approaching $4 trillion. It's the spending, stupid. Don't talk to me about taxes. And Milton Friedman was right. He says the tax levels are not what count. Government spending is what counts as a percentage of the economy. It doesn't matter if it's paid for in taxes or borrowing.
Sooner or later, it will be paid for by us.
Right. Right.
Okay, a couple big facts about American history. Here's one. Ronald Reagan, broadly speaking, cut taxes and rolled back regulations, and the economy boomed. And then Bill Clinton resists the left in his own party, essentially ratifying. He raises taxes a little bit, but he's essentially ratifying the Reagan program of relatively low tax regime, relatively limited regulation, and the economy continues to boom. So we get, in some modest way at least, the John Stossel program 25 years ago, and we get 25 years of economic growth as a result. And now we have Barack Obama saying Obamacare is a good thing, extending government control over 1/6 of the economy, and by the way, we need higher taxes. Democracy just doesn't work. We don't learn. We don't learn. We have the example before our very eyes, and we refuse to learn from it. Cheer me up.
No, I'm not going to argue with you. It's upsetting to me. Thomas Jefferson said the natural progress of things. Government grows, liberty yields.
So against that lamentable fact, which distresses both of us, you have the rise of the Tea Party. You have John's, this will surely be your third bestseller to the chagrin of the New York Times, which will rue the print it has, the ink it has to use to print it on the bestseller list. Do you sense the country in this election year moving into a kind of rebellion against this huge state, or at least against Barack Obama? That's not the case, though, is it? It's a close call, is it?
It's a close call, and the betting has Barack Obama likely to be reelected. The Tea Party was exciting, and some were holding the Constitution. Really? We're going to go back to that? I didn't even know people were interested. And
looks as though the Supreme Court might even go back to it if you, you listen to the oral arguments on Obamacare earlier.
But a lot of Tea Party people say, don't cut my Medicare, and nobody wants their programs cut. On the other hand, the positive side, I didn't think welfare reform was possible.
Right.
And we don't have to stop the growth of government. We just have to slow its growth. We could grow our way out of this. And Paul Ryan issues his budget plan. He gets portrayed as pushing grandma off a cliff. And in 7 months since he did that, the country's changed. Now he says, my plan was too timid. I'm ready to do a little more. So there's some movement.
Right. Okay. Here's another big fact about American history. From the New Deal on, federal welfare spending has increased in real terms every year. Even during the Reagan years, they shrink the growth rate. But there's no actual cut in welfare spending. It just keeps growing. And Milton Friedman told us why. Milton Friedman and James Buchanan and others have told us why. It's built into the structure. You talk here about intuition. What's built into us? There's something that's built into the structure of the government, namely a special interest will always have it in its interest to lobby for bigger, for a more government. If you're GM, you're very happy to get bailed out. If you're Goldman Sachs, you're very happy to get bailed out. If you're this or that insurance organization, you're very happy to cut a deal on Obamacare.
If I'm a cotton farmer, I'm going to fight for my subsidies.
Absolutely
if
right.
I'm a consumer, I'm only paying a buck or two.
And that's a hard, it's not quite the problem. Intuition is wrong. Because this is something where the rational actor who is responding to reality, this interest group, that interest group, the other interest group, it is they correctly judge it to be in their interest to push for more government. So what do we do about that?
You're depressing me. I don't know what to do. Jonathan Rauch called it demisclerosis. All I can say is there is one thing we can do to stop this. Buy everybody a copy of No, They Can't.
Okay.
Get me on the bestseller list with Rachel Maddow, and then the book gets discounted, and these ideas get out.
Okay, so here's one more. This is the question. It's still a question. I don't know the. I mean, we've moved to the portion of the program where we're asking questions where I really don't suspect that I know the answer. I really just want to hear what you have to say. So, set Barack Obama aside for a moment. I feel like Hannah Youngman. Take my wife, please. Set him aside, please. Chris Christie in New Jersey takes the unions on, frontal attack, and his ratings are now up. Bobby Jindal, attacks the bureaucracy in Louisiana, and he gets reelected by some 70%. You see governors taking Mitch Daniels in Indiana, now in, I think he's in his seventh year, he's deep into his second term, cuts taxes, gets a constitutional amendment to lower property taxes permanently, and the guy's ratings are in the 60 or 70%. So why does it work at the state level, at least when there's a governor who has real guts?
Ronald Reagan at the federal level. But I mean, I'm glad.
But now, see, here's the problem. Now we're creeping toward wanting heroes. And you've already told us we shouldn't be looking for heroes.
Well, we need a strong person to cut. That's true. We shouldn't think of them as heroes, but we want a strong person to cut. And also Canada cut. And Luis Fortunio in Puerto Rico fired 20,000 workers. Scott Walker in Wisconsin, all that fuss. He didn't fire anybody. And when I interviewed Fortunio, he said, my advice to politicians, do it early in your term, like a Band-Aid, rip it off. And then, like with Reagan, we will, you know, people don't want to see cuts. People don't want to see public sector workers fired. I do, but normal people don't. But they notice results. Right. So then we researched it. Yeah, I mean, there were these people you mentioned, and John Engler of Michigan.
Right.
And we couldn't find anybody else. In recent history. So I hope it can. I hope Fortunio gets to be popular. In Canada, it was a liberal government to do it. It was like Nixon going to China.
Right. Okay, segment five, our last segment, John. War and Peace. No, they can't. What intuition tempts us to believe lunatics want to murder us, so we must kill them over there before they kill us over here. What reality taught me, such thinking leads to an overextended military, close quote. So here's where we probe the extent to which you as a libertarian are willing to make common cause with conservatives and the extent to which, nope, you really are a libertarian and that leads to different conclusions. So are you with Ron Paul? The war in Iraq was a terrible mistake and we should get out of Afghanistan as fast as we can?
I mean, I cringe to say this on your television show, but yes.
Okay.
And to be clear, Ron Paul also says, if we get attacked, attack back. Right. And we were right to attack Afghanistan for harboring al-Qaeda. And I also begin the chapter by saying, I'm nervous about this one. I'm not a student of the military, but I'm just a guy who watches government fail. The military has a brownie recipe that's 25 pages long. Government is inefficient at everything it does. Why would nation building, why would defense be different?
Okay. Now, because I so like you and admire your work, John, I'm going to work really hard to find, but you would grant this much, I think. Excuse me. You would grant this much, I hope. Even our joint hero, Milton Friedman, would say that defense is one of the few legitimate duties of the federal government.
Absolutely. Okay. We need a strong military.
So isn't it the case? I'm just hoping that we can agree on a kind of little tiny piece of intellectual framework here. Isn't it the case that whereas when it comes to domestic spending, if you're not sure of the right amount to spend, you should for sure err on the side of spending less? Defense is different. If you're not sure of the right amount to spend, you ought to spend more. Don't you think?
Sure.
Okay.
But
great.
We need to reevaluate the mission. I mean, It's an automatic pilot. The same amount every year, Army, Navy, Air Force, just about. 30,000 troops in South Korea, they're freeloading off of us. 30,000 in Japan, 50,000
in Germany. Still, right.
Why?
Yeah, okay. The current political scene. I have to note, by the way, that in No, They Can't, you're as rough on Republicans as you are on Democrats. And you note that under George W. Bush, the Republicans engaged in the biggest increase in discretionary domestic spending since Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society.
And he hired 9,000 new regulators.
Did he? I didn't. Okay. So, the current scene. During oral arguments earlier this spring on the constitutionality of Obamacare, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy made the following observation. When the federal government tells the citizen he must purchase insurance or face penalties, then, quote, that changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way, close quote. You'd agree?
Yeah.
Okay. So how much of a problem is it that Mitt Romney enacted an individual mandate in Massachusetts and was willing for the state government to do what Justice Kennedy said the federal government could not do, without altering the relationship with the citizen fundamentally.
It's a problem for him. It is a defense, the defense he uses, that we've got 50 states. Don't we have 50 laboratories of democracy?
You're comfortable with that.
Well, no. I think the mandate is a problem. The Supreme Court, what they once ruled is this poor wheat farmer in Kansas, was it? He wasn't free to grow more wheat on his own land that he didn't even sell because it might affect the price elsewhere. And they get to control that. I mean, if the Supreme Court is now waking up and say this changes the relationship, good.
Okay.
Overdue.
See, what I'm poking around for here, we have this marvelous – by the way, I should state that it's beautiful.
Beautiful.
I did like the book. It is really – I keep quoting these summary statements, but the argument, the research, it's a really wonderful book, John. And it's an indictment. And what I'm trying to probe for here is how do you use the political system to fix some of this stuff? And so what I'm looking for here is the Stossel-o-meter. How enthusiastic can you be about Mitt Romney as the Republican nominee? I know you're libertarian. You'd prefer Ron Paul. Ron Paul ain't going to be the nominee. How do you...
He's going to catch on next week.
Okay. It isn't over yet.
People will wake up. And look, I would prefer Romney over Obama. But Romney says things like, I'm going to cut the government workforce 10% by attrition, he's quick to add.
Right.
I mean, by attrition, it's then the bad people stay, the good ones leave. That's not management. He's so afraid of making hard decisions. Jack Welch, when he ran GE, said it's the job of a manager to identify the bottom 10% and get them out.
Right.
It's creative destruction. But Romney, at least, wouldn't bloat government more, as President Obama continues to propose.
Okay. A little hard to get elected if the slogan is Romney, he's not as bad as the other guy, though. All right.
Maybe not.
All right. Again, individuals should act, not government. So let me probe you again. How should individuals who read this book think about their relation to the American political system? And this is on my mind because it's a conversation I had just a week ago with a friend who is a high-tech mogul, started a big company here, and like many of us, he's distressed about the state of affairs here in California. And I said, well, what do you intend to do about it? And he said, oh, nothing. I wrote off California years ago. Every bit of my energy I put into my company, I thought that's not just for profit, it's the best way I can do good in the amount of time that I have left to me. Well, on the one hand, that's a very bracing statement of the libertarian point of view. On the other hand, if all the good guys withdraw from politics, things get worse immediately. So what do you say about that?
Well, he's good at business, so he has a good argument to say, I'm good at helping people by expanding my business, and that's wonderful. That creates jobs and profits, which do good things. But you're right. We need participation. We need activists. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, we got to participate in politics. Go tell them, no, they can't. And maybe when we watch other countries blow up, and maybe California and Illinois will be our example of failure.
Oh, thanks a lot. We're doing a good job of cheering each other up here, John. No, they can't. Now, last question or a couple of questions here. Quote, it didn't take me long to understand. You're talking now about getting started in your career in television. Didn't take me long to understand that almost every news story should draw attention to some terrible problem, homelessness, illegitimacy, the crack cocaine epidemic. There was almost always just one answer, government should do something. That was the template for television journalism.
Still is.
And it still is. So what's your advice to the, let's just posit that there's a senior at Princeton graduating this June who's interested in journalism and wants to be like John Stossel. What's your advice?
Learn economics and look around. See the miracles the private sector does, that you can stick a piece of plastic in the wall and cash will come out. That you can go to a foreign country and hand that piece of plastic to a total stranger who doesn't even speak your language, and he'll rent you a car for a week. And when you get home, Visa or MasterCard will have the accounting correct to the penny. And government can't even count the votes accurately. So stop saying, government's got to do something. Government's got to do less. The founders had it right. America grew fastest when government was 1% or 2% of the economy. Let's move back in that direction. Let them leave us alone.
John Stossel, author of No, They Can't, Why Government Fails But Individuals Succeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
And keep that, put up the sign, would you please, one more time? No, They Can't. For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.